All right, 7-year-old Michael and 5-year-old Ryan were waiting for pancakes. Mom was cooking those up, and the first one came off, and she put it on a plate. Of course, they both wanted it. So she saw this as a great teaching moment. She said, "Now, boys, Jesus taught us to love each other. He taught us to share. What he would say is, let my brother have the first pancake." So Michael said, "Okay, Ryan, you can be Jesus." You know, sibling rivalry, sometimes it's pretty benign, like who's going to get the first pancake. I told you I have brother and sister, grew up together. Our family moved my mom and dad this week into a house. They've lived in the same home for 61 years, and we moved them into a house that they built together with my sister and brother-in-law. And on Thursday night, my brother and I were putting their bed back together. Now, if you've ever met my brother, he's one of those 10-talent kind of guys. Man, I mean, he just is. He's a doctor. He was valedictorian in college. He's an artist. He's a musician. And oh yeah, he plays guitars that he built when he leads worship. I mean, it just makes you sick. He's one of those kind of guys. He's also very handy. He can fix anything. And so we're putting the bed back together, and he needed a couple of screws, and he didn't have them. So I throw open my toolbox. I get them out and say, "Yeah, come on. Who's Mr. Fix It Now, rookie?" And, I'm just saying, because that's just kind of the way it goes. Sibling rivalry, right? Well, sometimes the stakes are a little higher than this. Brothers Peyton Manning and Eli Manning that we saw in the commercial, both at one time NFL quarterbacks, both amazing players, both of them won 2 Super Bowls. Only in the 3 games that they played against each other during their careers, Peyton's team won all 3. Sibling rivalry, sometimes it's pretty lighthearted. Sometimes it gets pretty intense. But sometimes it takes a dark turn. You remember in our series about King David back earlier this year, David's son Absalom killed his brother Amnon. This past Tuesday, David and Samuel Rogers were convicted in Birmingham of killing their younger brother Thomas. And earlier this month, a man in Illinois shot and killed his half-brother during a dispute about the COVID vaccine. Sibling rivalry is not always fun and games. This morning, we're continuing our series in the early chapters of Genesis. The series is called Epic. And today we're going to look at the second recorded sin in the Bible and the first recorded murder. Genesis chapter 4, verse 8 says, "One day Cain suggested to his brother, 'Let's go out into the fields.' And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Afterward, the Lord asked Cain, 'Where's your brother? Where is Abel?' 'I don't know,' Cain responded. 'Am I my brother's guardian?'" Or maybe you've heard that translated, "Am I my brother's keeper?" And the answer is, yes, you are. Let's close in prayer. Sorry, no. Actually, before we wrap up, there's a little bit more that we need to sort out, okay? For instance, why did Cain kill Abel? What happens when we have unresolved anger inside? How does sin get a foothold in our lives? What is the mark of Cain that the Bible talks about? Where did Cain find a wife? And is it true that Cain had twin daughters, Candy and Sugar? Come on, Cain, all right. Just give me a quick little hand up if you have younger brothers and sisters, or sisters. Just a quick, okay, a whole lot of you, all right? Those of us who are the baby in the family understand that parents typically kept trying till they got it right, okay? I think the pictures speak for themselves, okay? I'm just saying. Now, for those of you who are older, I wonder if you were old enough to remember the birth of the younger brothers and sisters. You're the center of the world. All eyes are on you, and all of a sudden, there's another little person. And it's a very noisy person. And it's a very demanding person. And this is a person who needs constant care. And a lot of that attention that was focused on you is not focused on you anymore. What's it like when you were the center of the world and now you're not? I have to believe that's a little bit of what's going on here with Abel. Cain was not only the firstborn child to Adam and Eve, he was the firstborn child, period. He was it, the first baby. And then Abel comes along and suddenly all that attention was lost. And sometimes the jealousy and the tension goes on for years. Here's how the book of Genesis records these two brothers. Genesis 4 begins this way. Now Adam had sexual relations with his wife Eve, and she became pregnant. When she gave birth to Cain, she said, "With the Lord's help, I have produced a man." And I'm thinking Adam's going, "Oh, you and the Lord, huh? Am I chopped liver here? I mean, what's the deal? I mean, I thought I was a part of this whole gig." But anyway, there's another baby. Verse 2, later Eve gave birth to his brother and named him Abel. And when they grew up, Abel became a shepherd while Cain cultivated the ground. Cain and Abel had the same parents, but they were as different as night and day. Like a lot of brothers, like a lot of sisters, like a lot of siblings are. Cain was a farmer. He loved working the land. He loved to see the earth produce a harvest. Abel was a shepherd. Man, he was more interested in livestock than in vegetables. He would rather, you know, drive a flock across the pasture or lead a flock than ride a tractor across the field. I mean, that was just kind of the way he was built, the way he was wired, okay? And there's nothing wrong with either occupation. In fact, you would think this worked out pretty well. You've got Cain providing the produce. You've got Abel making sure that there's meat, milk, even wool. Seems like a pretty good arrangement. Except for one thing, Cain stumbled when it came to his relationship with God. Genesis chapter 4, verse 3. When it was time for the harvest, Cain presented some of his crops as a gift to the Lord. Abel also brought a gift, the best of the firstborn lambs from his flock. The Lord accepted Abel and his gift, but he did not accept Cain and his gift. This made Cain very angry, and he looked dejected. Now, these verses are as interesting for what they don't say as they are for what they do. First of all, what led Cain and Abel to give gifts to God in the first place? I mean, there was no law that commanded them to bring sacrifices. God had not told them to, in any way, bring things to him. Was this something that their mom and dad came up with? Was this something they came up with on their own? We don't know. And then it says that God was pleased with Abel's sacrifice, but not with Cain's. What's that all about? Well, one possibility is that Abel brought a blood sacrifice and Cain only brought vegetables. And yet there's nothing in the text that suggests that's a problem. I mean, this was thousands of years before God even commanded people to bring blood sacrifices to him. I think we kind of get a clue here into this by the wording of the text. It says that Cain brought or presented some of his crops, but Abel produced the best of his flock. You kind of get a sense that Cain offered something. Maybe it was mediocre, half-hearted, not really much of a gift. Abel brought the best. You know, when I was a kid in Sunday school years ago, we would occasionally have a canned food drive where kids would bring food for the pantry at church. And kids would, you know, we'd go home, we'd dig around in the cupboard, and we'd find stuff to bring. But we brought stuff that wasn't terribly interesting. You look in the box there at church, you never saw the really good stuff like Chef Boyardee ravioli, you know, or Denny Moore beef stew. And there was none of that kind of stuff. It was creamed peas, you know, or hominy, whatever the heck hominy is. That was the kind of junk that ended up in this box. We were not really bringing our best to the Lord. Abel brought to God the best of his lambs, and Cain brought hominy. And you even get the idea here that this was not the top of the line hominy, okay? I don't even know what hominy is, but it wasn't the best hominy, okay? He just brought something, and God was displeased. You know, in the New Testament, 1 John chapter 3, it says this, verse 12, "We must not be like Cain, who belonged to the evil one and killed his brother." And why did he kill him? Because Cain had been doing what was evil, and his brother had been doing what was righteous. And then another insight, Hebrews 11:4, "It was by faith that Abel brought a more acceptable offering to God than Cain did. Abel's offering gave evidence that he was a righteous man, and God showed his approval of his gifts. Although Abel is long dead, he still speaks to us by his example of faith." Abel's gift was more acceptable, so Cain killed him. It's not that Abel was doing something evil, so Cain was stopping him. Cain was the one who was doing something evil. You know, sometimes when you're up to no good, the last thing you want to do is be around somebody who's doing the right thing. It just makes you feel more guilty. It makes you feel more uncomfortable. When you're crooked, you hate to be around somebody who is a person of integrity. And so Cain wasn't giving his best, Abel was. Rather than Cain being motivated to step up his game, maybe to do a better job, to bring his best to God after all, no, he just decided to get rid of the competition, lock him in the closet like we saw in the commercial, but literally get rid of the competition. Now, it didn't happen right away. You get the sense that the tension kind of built up over time. Look at verse 6. "Why are you so angry?" the Lord asked Cain. "Why do you look so dejected? You will be accepted if you do what is right. But if you refuse to do what is right, then watch out. Sin is crouching at the door, eager to control you, but you must subdue it and be its master." God said, "Cain, why are you angry?" And there's no suggestion here that he said anything at all in response. This is the old, "What's wrong?" Nothing. "Are you mad?" No. "You seem mad." "I'm not mad." "Okay, can we talk about what you're not mad about?" "Dang it, I'm not mad." You've had those kind of conversations. You know what I'm talking about. But you know, I have found that God is fairly perceptive. So even though Cain doesn't answer the question, God has a few things to say. Essentially, Cain, you're angry at the wrong person. Abel is not the problem here. You're the problem. Cain, it is within your power to be accepted. There is nothing preventing you from doing the right thing. This is why I don't think it was a problem that he was bringing vegetables to God. It's just that he was bringing subpar vegetables. If vegetables were the problem, God might have said, "Look, why don't you be a shepherd like your brother? You know, I like hamburger, not hominy." He might have been more clear, but he said, "Look, you have within your power right now to do the right thing." Only he didn't do the right thing. And God said, "Cain, if you refuse to do what's right, the sin that is tormenting you is going to control you. And if you think you're miserable now, just wait till you lose control." God told Cain to suck it up, to stop sinning, and to do the right thing. It was within his power to do that. But he refused to change. Instead, he ambushed his brother. He invited him out into the field, probably to get away from mom and dad, and he killed him. You know, it's interesting. God had not given the law yet. Nobody had ever said that murder was illegal. But Cain instinctively knew that he was about to do something wrong, something bad. And so he had to set a plan so that he could not be discovered. At least that's what he thought. And did you notice it really wasn't like a fit of rage kind of a thing? This was a planned attack. I don't know if he whacked him with a club, did he push him over a cliff, did he stab him with a knife that he had made out of flint? We don't know. But Cain knew exactly what he was going to do when he asked Abel to take a walk with him out into the field. Even today, you know, the law is a little more lenient with people when they commit a crime in a fit of passion. But when it's premeditated, man, there's just not much mercy there. It's a cold-blooded person who attacks an unarmed, innocent man. And when it's your own flesh and blood, it's even worse. God was quick to pronounce judgment, especially after Cain refused to take responsibility for what he had done. Listen again to verse 8. Cain suggested to his brother, "Let's go out into the fields." While they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. And afterward, the Lord asked Cain, "Where's your brother? Where's Abel?" "I don't know," Cain responded. "Am I my brother's guardian, my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." Have you ever read the short story by Edgar Allan Poe, The Telltale Heart? Man, you talk about a creepy story. I remember in elementary school, our teacher had a little record player in the classroom, and she played a record of somebody reading that story with sound effects in elementary school. Now you got a whole class that needs counseling, for crying out loud. I mean, what's she thinking? But anyway, this guy murders a man, and he hides the body under the floorboards of the house. And he thinks he's gotten away with it, only the police show up, and they start to question him. And while he's being interrogated, he starts to hear this heartbeat. And it's kind of soft at first. But as the questioning goes on, the heartbeat gets louder and it gets louder. And he gets more and more uncomfortable as the guilt intensifies. And he's kind of slipping into madness. And the sound just gets louder and louder and louder. And he knows the police hear it. And he knows that they're going to arrest him anyway. So he blurts out the whole thing so they will stop that heart from beating, the heartbeat that only he can hear. Here in Genesis, Cain is not the one hearing the heartbeat. It's God. God says, "The blood of Cain is crying out to me from the ground." Excuse me, the blood of Abel's blood. And so God says, "Cain, what have you done?" And then comes the punishment, verse 11. Now you are cursed, God says. You're banished from the ground, which has swallowed your brother's blood. No longer will the ground yield good crops for you, no matter how hard you work. From now on, you will be a homeless wanderer on the earth. And Cain lost the two most important things to him, his job and his family. He would no longer be a successful farmer. He would now be separated from his parents as he set out on his own. If only he had thought about the consequences before he did this horrible thing. Verse 13, Cain replied to the Lord, "My punishment's too great for me to bear. You've banished me from the land and from your presence. You've made me a homeless wanderer. Anyone who finds me will kill me." Cain said, "My punishment is too much, too great to bear." It can also be translated that my sin or my iniquity is too great to bear. So we don't really know if he is feeling this guilt and shame over what he's done, or he's just upset because he got caught. The consequences are too extreme. But either way, whether he's sorry for what he did or he's just feeling sorry for himself, either way, he's afraid that people are going to come after him and kill him for what he's done. And that raises a pretty important question. What people? So far, we've heard about Adam and Eve. We've heard about Cain and Abel. Who else is there? Well, you need to understand, we read these verses all right together pretty quickly, but decades and decades of time have gone on from when God created Adam and Eve and when all of these things are happening. Adam and Eve had numerous other children. The Bible records often the birth of the firstborn son, and then just kind of says other sons and daughters. You read the genealogies. So-and-so was the father of so-and-so, and then he had other sons and daughters. And these were big families. Later in Genesis 4, we do find out that Adam and Eve's son Seth became the head of the house after Cain was banished. Even though he wasn't the oldest, the firstborn, he was kind of next in line at this point. Seth became the leader of the family, his big family. So yet Cain worried in this conversation with God that maybe somebody's going to come after him, that somebody is going to try to do him in because of what he's done. So notice that God did not say, "Well, man, tough luck, pal. If only you'd thought about that before you did this. But I wash my hands of you now." That's not what he says. Verse 15, the Lord replied, "No," in other words, "that's not going to happen. For I will give a sevenfold punishment to anyone who kills you." Then the Lord put a mark on Cain to warn anyone who might try to kill him. Amazing. In the middle of this pronouncement of punishment, God offered protection for Cain. If anybody tried to take justice into their own hands and kill him, they would suffer vengeance seven times over. And then somehow, God put a mark on Cain to protect him. Now, how did he do that? We don't know. The New Living Translation says that the Lord put a mark on Cain. It can also be translated, the Lord gave a mark to Cain. Was it a physical mark, something on his body, or was it something that God gave him, something like a get-out-of-jail-free card, you know, in Monopoly? Here, Cain, tuck this in your wallet. If anybody comes after you, you just pull this out. Everything's going to be okay. We have no idea. Over the centuries, people have made up all kinds of crazy suggestions about what the mark of Cain was. God gave him a dog. Somebody actually suggested that. God gave him a brightly colored coat, which sounds kind of like another Bible story they're kind of ripping that off from. God put a horn on Cain's forehead, okay? That's a possibility. Some idiot somewhere suggested that Cain became the first black man, and that was the mark of Cain. Ridiculous. I have a friend who said God gave him red hair. That's not funny. Okay, I'm just saying, I had a friend who suggested that. We don't know what Cain's mark was, but in his mercy, God did something that would help protect him from people seeking revenge. Somehow he designated Cain off limits. Now, before we get to just a few quick lessons, I want you to notice verse 16. It says, "So Cain left the Lord's presence, and he settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden." Cain left the Lord's presence. I don't know how much to read into that. Cain left the Lord's presence. Does that mean that the two of them were just having a meeting and then Cain left and went on his way? Or does it mean something more extreme, that Cain walked away from God in some way, that he turned his back on God once and for all? I don't know. Maybe Cain had a different attitude toward God after this experience than he ever had before. It's possible. But no matter what's actually going on here, God never stopped caring about Cain. That's the beauty of this picture between the two of them here. God showed him mercy. He gave Cain the opportunity to be restored into a right relationship with God. Now, I think that there are several quick lessons we can take from this epic story of sin and consequences, and then I want to give you one kind of key one. But here we go. God deserves our very best. That's just one quick lesson. God deserves our best. This whole mess started because Cain was sloppy in his relationship with God. Throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament, we see over and over again that God deserves our best. What would be arrogance for anybody else saying, well, you owe me your best, you know? Well, God's like the, you know, he's the king of the universe. And so he can say, I expect your best. He's overall, we owe him everything. So when he says, give me your best, it's fair. And I think that's reflected, honestly, in how we sing during worship, in how we give our offerings to him, in how we serve at church, in how we just live our lives every day. It's reflected that we're giving God our best. Another lesson is that sin can master us if we give it a foothold. God personifies sin in verse 7 here. He says, sin is crouching at the door, eager to control you. You must subdue it and be its master. Sin is crouching tiger, hidden dragon. It's just always ready to attack. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul talked about our human nature, our sinful nature, and he talked about God's nature in us and how those two natures are constantly at war with one another. There's a temptation a lot of times in our lives to just kind of dabble in sin. Just one little step in won't hurt anything. We think we're in control, and then if we aren't careful, one day we're not in control anymore. That's what happened to Cain, and it can happen to anybody. Another lesson is that God shows mercy even when we don't deserve it. God shows mercy to us even when we don't deserve it. This whole interaction between Cain and God is so intriguing to me. The Old Testament is filled with stories of God getting vengeance, showing justice, especially in the Old Testament. There are wars of annihilation where whole cities are destroyed. There's divine retribution. Next week, we're going to talk about Noah and this great flood that wiped out mankind. Over and over again, we kind of see God trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored, you know? But here in this picture, or in this story, is this beautiful picture of God's mercy. That Cain deserved to die for his actions. Later on, in fact, God's going to declare that anybody who sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. That murder is going to become a capital offense, a life for a life. And we're not going to get into a discussion on the death penalty right now. I'm just saying that in the Old Testament times, murder was a capital offense. And here, in his mercy, God decided to spare Cain and even protect him. God has this amazing way of guiding us back onto the right path when we start to stray. And sometimes that's really painful, but it's always for the best. So God deserves our best. Sin can master us if we give it a foothold, and God shows mercy even when we don't deserve it. My bottom line this morning, kind of just one thing to take with you, is a little different than normal. Last week it was a question, which is not typical. Today there's a question and an answer, and here it is. Am I my brother's keeper? Yes, I am. Am I my sister's keeper? Yes, I am. Yes, you are. There you go. We are all each other's keepers. Galatians 6:2 in the New Testament, carry each other's burdens, and in this way you obey the law of Christ. Romans 15:1, we who are strong ought to bear with the failings of the weak. Carry each other's burdens. Be your brother's keeper. James 1:27, pure and genuine religion in the sight of God the Father means caring for orphans and widows in their distress. And then in 1 John chapter 3, it says this, verse 11, this is the message you've heard from the beginning. We should love one another. We must not be like Cain, who belonged to the evil one and killed his brother. Verse 15, anyone who hates another brother or sister is really a murderer at heart. And you know that murderers don't have eternal life within them. We know what real love is because Jesus gave up his life for us. So we also ought to give up our lives for our brothers and sisters. If someone has enough money to live well and sees a brother or sister in need but shows no compassion, how can God's love be in him? Dear children, let's not merely say that we love each other. Let us show the truth by our actions. Am I my brother's keeper? Yes, I am. Many of you have heard me talk about my friend Dave Kennedy. For over 30 years, he's been my closest friend in ministry. Now, we are not exactly peers when it comes to age. When I was in middle school, Dave was already a preacher with a family up in Louisville. He was on the faculty of White Mills Christian Camp when I went there as a kid. Gail and I went to college with his oldest daughter. Well, in January of 1990, I got to join a sermon study group, a sermon writing group with Bob Russell and Wayne Smith, Dave Stone, several other guys were there, and Dave Kennedy was in that group. And man, we became friends, just the best of friends. We both enjoyed photography. Here's a picture that I took. He didn't smoke cigars. I said, would you light up a cigar for me? I want to try to get this picture. And we did that. We took some photo trips together. We occasionally played golf together. Probably the most fun thing is that we'd play basketball sometimes in the gym at Southeast, and we'd go in, two old guys, he was in his 60s then. We'd go in, we'd play basketball with a couple of teenagers. They'd look at him like, psh, and then he'd run circles around them because he was just so fit, you know. He was just that kind of guy, and we have so many great memories. There were seasons of time, years of time, when we would write sermons together over the phone. We each had a headset, and we'd be sitting at the computer working, and it might be quiet for 15 minutes, and then he'd say, listen to this, and he'd read me a paragraph, and I'd say, listen to this, and we'd try, and we just went back and forth, and we'd work hours together. You know, one of my favorite memories of Dave might sound kind of strange to you, but it was 11:30 or so on a Saturday night, and my phone rang. And I was the preacher at that time up at Fern Creek Christian Church, and he was preaching at Eastside Christian Church in Clarksville, Indiana. And this was before cell phones were common. It was before internet. We had computers, but they were like word processors, really. And Dave and I had worked together all week on a sermon, but for some reason, whatever he had stuff going on, he had not printed until he was getting ready to print it out on Saturday night. And he went to print his sermon, and his computer locked up and shut down, and it was over. And he was feeling pretty desperate. And so he called me up, and I printed out a copy of my sermon. We met in the middle, and he took it, reworked it through the night, and he preached the next morning. And you know what? That was not a burden to me at all. That was such a gift to me. That this guy that I've loved and respected all these years, that he needed a favor from me and I got to do this for him. I mean, that kind of sealed our friendship in a lot of ways. And then a number of years later, probably about 9 years ago, I was going through absolutely the toughest time of my life. And I would go see him every week in his office and I would spend an hour or two with him. And he would let me talk and cry and cuss a little. And he would just take it, you know, he would listen. And he'd pray for me, and he'd say, you know what, it's going to get better. And he was right, it got better. And that's the kind of friendship that we had. This past Tuesday, I was listening to a video, a teaching video, about the 23rd Psalm, and it was about the verse, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you're with me. The Lord is with me. And I'm listening to this message about death and about grief and about loss. And my phone buzzed, and I looked at the text, and I found out that my friend David had a stroke, and he was on life support. And his heart kept beating for 2 more days, but he was gone, and he died on Thursday morning. I will miss him every day. Am I my brother's keeper? Yep. And so are you. And it's a privilege. It's a responsibility that we have. You know, it's why we do things like have blood drives here, and good job on Tuesday with that, by the way. It's why we meet together in small groups. It's why we share meals together with one another. It's why we support local ministries and ministries internationally. It's why many of you support sponsor a child in Uganda, because we are our brother's keeper. It's why we give to the needy and we encourage the weak. And we visit the sick. We care about orphans and widows. It's why we rejoice with those who rejoice and we weep with those who weep. Because we are each other's keepers. That's what we are. It's what we do. Can you imagine if Cain had decided that as an older brother, he was going to be Abel's keeper? That he was going to not harm him, but protect him. That he was going to be a good big brother. That he was going to encourage him. That he was going to even maybe learn something from him. If Cain had done that, if he had been proactive, not reactive, everything could have been different. But instead, he ruined his own life and he ruined the life of his brother. He ended the life of his brother. It could have been so different. And friends, it can be so different if we decide, I am my brother's keeper. I am. Let's pray. Well, Father, all the way back at the beginning, it didn't take long for mankind to stumble into sin, even very grievous sin. And Lord, we look at our lives and we know how easy it is, maybe not to murder, but it's easy not to care. It's easy to be selfish. It's easy to be so self-focused that we miss what's right in front of us. God, help us to be each other's keepers, not to be controlling, not to be nosy, but to show compassion. God, to make a difference in people's lives, to realize that the good news of Jesus Christ is our ultimate hope. And God, we've got to share that. We've got to show the love of Christ. Help us to treat people the way he did. Help us to live lives that put others first. Even as he went to the cross, he was doing it for us. God, may we live the kinds of lives that are sacrificial, that our love is unconditional, and that we do what we can to make a difference. That's our prayer, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.